Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show, bringing you the entire world as depicted by the movies. Give us 20 odd minutes and we shall bring you love, sex, emotional meltdown and Armageddon. And best of all, some of this will come via the medium of song. Clearing its throat on this week's show, James McAvoy hits the rocks in the scabrous cop saga Filth. Mark Ruffalo and Gwyneth Paltrow have problems downstairs in the sex addict rom-com Thanks for Sharing. And Saoirse Ronan finds love amid the ruins in the young adult drama How I Live Now. Kicking off the show, however, we have Sunshine on Leith, a karaoke musical based on the back catalogue of those Scottish troubadours, The Proclaimers. And don't worry if you're unfamiliar with the music of The Proclaimers, by the end of the film, you'll feel that they've lived with you your entire life, singing incessantly right into your ear.
Oh, that's bogging. Right, Lizzie, up to us when you store these.
Okay.
Drunken storytelling, no one sings.
Okay.
This is the story of our first Shetland made her jumpers and the devil made her features.
George McKay and Kevin Guthrie play two Scottish squaddies just back from Afghanistan and looking for love in picturesque Edinburgh. Their lives are mapped out in Proclaimers songs, and they're going to walk 500 miles on a kind of entertainment tour of duty. Joining me now is the Guardian's Catherine Shaw and Henry Barnes. Catherine, rather to my surprise, I quite like this.
I know, weird, isn't it? Because it sounds horrific written down on paper, but really fun, and you can't get them out of your head, the tunes, in a good way.
Yeah.
And it's sort of smiley, and you just, it's, you know, young, good-looking people breaking into song in a way that doesn't make you vomit.
And the fact that they're kind of songs that are designed for sort of rough-and-ready pub sing-alongs works when it's amateurish singers and dancers. I mean, yeah. these aren't your natural Broadway stars, are they?
They're not. And I think the unfamiliarity of the Proclaimer songs, I mean, I didn't know more than two of them, helps because you're not always sort of waiting for it. Like with Mamma Mia, you're thinking, oh, Christ, he's called Fernando, you know, and it's like that. And so with this, you sort of, it feels a bit more organic, although not quite.
Mm. It is a little bit geared around the songs. There's a point where the daughter gets a job in America, and you think, I wonder if there's a song that's appropriate at this point.
But they didn't make it 500 miles away, which is, you know, subtlety.
Mm. And or should be in the middle of the Atlantic. Inevitably, it's going to be compared to Mamma Mia, and possibly this is the start of a franchise where every band gets their musical. And yeah, I preferred it to Mamma Mia. It doesn't have that slightly kind of tinny gloss that Mamma Mia had. It doesn't have the Greek island for a start, it doesn't have Meryl, and it's much more small scale and hand-tooled. And a nice sense of Edinburgh, the kind of Edinburgh that we don't really see, the kind of working Edinburgh of pubs and
yeah, you get a little bit of that, but you also get a lot of things shot in cafes which give you a glorious view of...
Yeah, there's a lot of aerial shots as well.
And you can't...
like that.
But you, I mean, the climactic scene, you know, there's the art gallery with their big exhibitions for the year being previewed. You know, it really is. I mean, it's very tourist.
It's a bit, yeah.
I mean, which I didn't mind.
I think that the real benefit of this is going to be the Proclaimers themselves, aren't they? This is the best thing that's ever happened to them, surely.
It'd be amazing. No, they must be really surprised.
And yet they get this little kind of Hitchcockian cameo at the start.
Oh,
where
I missed that.
You missed that. You're unfamiliar with them. They come out of the cafe when the two squaddies are walking into town. Mm. And they come out as the squaddies are singing and they look at each other and go, no. And you think, now that's a bit churlish. This is somebody doing you the most enormous favour. They've rescued you from oblivion.
Yeah,
you can at least kind of tap your feet and sing along.
And I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more just to be the one who walks
That sunshine on Leith singing its way through the streets of Edinburgh. And the whole place looks so fetching that I think we'll stay there for our next film, Filth, which contains no songs but does feature James McAvoy as a friendly neighbourhood bobby. The Guardian's Henry Barnes went to get the lowdown from McAvoy and author Irving Welsh.
I think there's something seriously wrong with me.
Have you been to see a doctor?
Have you been since our last consultation? No problems, I presume.
Bruce is somebody who's sick, essentially. So all his bad behaviour and all his un-PC behaviour and all his sexism and racism and homophobia and misogyny and sectarianism, it's a symptom of his sickness.
With the transport and drug thing, this is the kind of same thing with mental illness. You have to kind of you have to engage with it in a kind of very humanistic way. You can't just kind of sort of say, this is terrible, this is, you know, it's like, you've got to look at all aspects of it, and you've got to allow an audience to a little bit of levity as well from the extreme tension. And I mean, laughter isn't always about humour, about finding something funny. It's about a reduction of tension, which enables us to deal with the next bit of kind of extreme material that's going to come our way.
My experience of mental illness is that there's an incredible sort of imagination, and because of that, a sort of freeing of the intelligence that can come. I'm not saying it always does, but I think it's why it's quite often quite hard to diagnose people with certain forms of mental illness, because, you know, there's a kind of intellect boost sometimes, or a wit boost, or a something comes with it, you know? And I'm not saying that Bruce is very intelligent in this film. He's not half as clever as he thinks he is. But he's definitely thinking fast, and he's definitely thinking with his wits.
Could go either way. I find all this just a little bit sorted.
What made you join the force, Bruce?
Police oppression, brother.
And you wanted to stamp it out from the inside?
No, I wanted to be a part of it.
Henry, who would have thought that a cop on drugs would be such a recipe for disaster?
Yeah, no, it's not like we've ever seen it before, right?
He's not quite Harvey Keitel in Bad Lieutenant, though, is it? He doesn't have quite that sort of voltage.
No, he doesn't. And I think part of the problem is that the film's trying to straddle two things. It's trying to show you this hedonistic, almost poppy 90s-style filmmaking and show it as a lot of fun. And then it's supposed to be about a guy who's suffering from a serious mental illness brought on by intense grief. And there's this huge pivot point in the middle where you realise these two things are supposed to be going side by side, and it just falls off the edge of the cliff at that point. But, you know, until then, there's some nice stuff in there. Like Eddie Marson has this kind of dorky mate who gets pulled up and goes down a disco and dances with these two guys with fluorescent lights around his neck. You know, there's enough fun imagery in there to keep it going, I think.
Good support from John Sessions as well.
I love John Sessions. Yeah. We don't see enough of
John
Sessions.
We don't. Well, I think at one stage we saw way too much of John Sessions.
I wasn't really alive then.
No, you weren't around. Yeah. It's back when you could still get change from a shilling for a John Sessions film.
No, I thought John Sessions... I mean, in a good cast, and Jim Broadbent, sort of horrific character and a dubiously realised vision of the tapeworm episode in the book. But, yeah, I mean, incredibly memorable, incredibly sort of well done. I disagree about the Marson thing. I thought that was clichéd and boring. But I completely agree about how it's trying to have its cake and eat it. So it sort of shows you, you're meant to think McAvoy's really cool and all this, you know, it's... but also, yeah, complete suicidal breakdown brought on by intense grief and you know, bereavement.
But isn't that the inbuilt problem of all those kind of films? We were talking about it last week with that dreadful Runner, which is the, you know, those films do this thing where they show you this world and they say, look, it's really exciting, but hang on, maybe it's not. Maybe it's got a dark side.
I mean, it's a high level to compare it to, but if you go back to Trainspotting, like that did grief and tragedy really well alongside comedy and very broad humour.
Yeah, you know? And it showed how that life can be exciting as totally destructive.
And all of these things are interwoven. And I think that is probably Irvin Welsh at his best. Like, he does this thing where it's a hedonistic lifestyle that is always scored through with comedy and tragedy at the same time. This one, they're delineated. They're both separated from each other, and you lose something because of that, I think.
So did you find the second half less successful?
You know, I thought it wasn't terribly brilliant and it wasn't to my taste, but I was never bored. It really kept me gripped. And, you know, I never found it ludicrous, even though you have all these sort of, as I say, dubiously realised bits.
Jamie Bell.
He wasn't in it that much. Yeah. I mean, it didn't really trouble me. I thought McAvoy's gurning face, slightly tipped. I mean, it's a very energetically breakout performance into something different. He's produced it as well. But, yeah.
Well, everybody's kind of a little bit over the top here, and that's sort of appropriate.
But it's meant to be McAvoy's great big, you know, great big thing, isn't it? I mean, that's its sort of point. One doesn't feel it would have got off the ground without that. Yeah, but it's kind of keeps you watching.
As your colleague and as a human being, I'm telling you, Bruce, you've got some stuff to sort out. Okay? You might become the sort of person that you seem to imagine yourself to be, although Christ only knows what that is.
I used to be good at this job, Amanda. I used to be a good person.
Yeah, I heard that.
James McAvoy going what physicians describe as absolutely bug-eyed bonkers in filth. And after all that, it's high time we left Edinburgh behind and repaired to the bedroom. Thanks for Sharing stars Tim Robbins, Mark Ruffalo and Gwyneth Paltrow. And at least one of these people is addicted to what physicians describe as knocking boots.
So, how's the dating? What? Come on, you got 5 years. It's time. The point isn't to live like a monk. It's easy to be skinny on a desert island.
I know.
It's not like booze or drugs. You don't have to shut it off completely.
Jesus, I'll start dating.
Don't just say that to shut me up.
What do you want? What do you want me to say?
I don't want you to say anything. I want you to do.
Okay, fine. I'll do it.
Yeah, you are?
Yes, I'm doing it.
Yeah, good.
Why couldn't I have picked an easy sponsor? Why?
Cold showers all round for the cast of Thanks for Sharing, a film that hops between the comedy and the drama with sweat on its brow and its hands on its flies. Mark Ruffalo is the recovering sex addict who discovers that a problem shared is a problem at least two people have got.
So, I'm going to hear your first step after this, right?
Oh, sure. Neil. I've been working on it all week. I totally forgot that we were doing
you
that
You do
tonight.
Remember why you're in this program, right?
Free bagels?
You were court-ordered. Frittage. Unconsensual touching other people.
I know.
Listen, Neo, you gotta do the work. You have to do whatever it takes. You think I like not having a television or a laptop? It blows, but guess what? It's saving my life, so I do it.
Catherine, you saw this about 15 months ago at the Toronto Film Festival. Why has it taken so long to get there? Is it too dangerous?
It could be that. Other reasons.
Can we handle it now that we just couldn't a year ago?
That's right. Shame has sort of paved the way, has undressed us. And it's like shame, exclamation mark. It's like the comedy version. There's no songs, but it's like that. And the weird thing is that for all its sort of crassness and obviously inferiority to that film, it's probably more realistic in some ways, because you've got these three sex addicts. You've got Mark Ruffalo, who hasn't even masturbated for 5 years. It's true.
What is wrong with the man?
Because he did a lot of it before.
Right. He's tapped out.
He's not tapped out. And, but he gives... Anyway, not going to spoil it. And Tim Robbins, who I think has got lots of problems, but he's clean at the moment. And Josh Gad, in his pre-slimline years, and he's addicted to porn. And also he sort of puts cameras up skirts a lot.
Right.
And he's meant to be the kind of lovable one. Anyway, and there's Pink.
He's just a harmless sex pest.
Yeah, that's right. And there's Pink as well, and she's a sex addict.
So what exactly is wrong with it? It's a bit soulless, it's a bit machine-tooled, what?
I suppose the thing is that although it's probably more believable than Shame, the thing about Shame was, although it was beautifully realised, it was sort of unbelievable in terms of the fact that Fassbender was, you know, your ultimate hottie, and even the prostitutes were having fun. Whereas this, you don't believe it for a second. The scenarios are probably more realistic, but none of it rings true for a nanosecond because it's also perfectly realised in terms of this kind of screenplay, which comes together perfectly.
No pun intended.
Yeah, puns intended, but tried to be avoided.
You know, if it keeps going well, you gotta tell her, right?
Is that a sobriety medallion?
I've been in recovery for 5 years.
For what?
Sex addiction.
Isn't that something that guys just say when they get caught cheating?
Sex addiction under the microscope in Thanks for Sharing. And our advice, of course, is just say no. Moving swiftly on, we come to our final film of the week. And fittingly enough, it's the end of the world.
This is how you make the best marshmallows. Place it in quite a small place. Make sure it's quite a hot
Don't put it in for too long.
Try some of this.
Do I have to?
Yes, it's really good.
These are actually pretty good.
How I Live Now, directed by Kevin MacDonald from the book by Meg Rossoff, is a coming-of-age yarn played out beneath a mushroom cloud. Saoirse Ronan stars as the scratchy American teenager who flies into bucolic rural England just ahead of World War III. The bodies are piling up, the fallout is blowing, and all at once she's a long way from home.
What's happening?
Henry, it's like a young adult version of The Road, this, isn't it?
It is, or like Children of Men, or maybe even like When the Wind Blows. It reminded me of that as well. And when it got to that point, I really liked it. There's a point where a nuclear explosion goes off, and this is fairly early in the film, so it's not a spoiler. And there's just a stillness in the scene, and this dust starts floating down. You get the fallout coming across already. I thought that was fantastic, and I really wanted to see a lot more of that. And I really like Kevin MacDonald. I think Saoirse Ronan is great, but most of this just plays out like teen Armageddon with a love story that feels unnecessary and an adventure that isn't actually that thrilling. They're just kind of stomping through the fallout for the rest of the two-hour film.
It's kind of tense in places, though, isn't it? I mean, there's definitely threats in the forest and all the kind of tropes of that kind of film.
There are. It's just that her goal, ultimately, is to get back to this kind of hunky country bumpkin played by George
MacKay. Her cousin, who she's known for about three days.
And, yeah, their relationship isn't particularly well put together. And just as a goal to just try and get back to a guy that you fancy when the world's ending around you doesn't really seem like much of an ambition. I don't know, find something to eat, maybe, you know, clean drinking water.
Oh, you're so prosaic.
No, I'm not very romantic. But then also, George MacKay is fine in this, but he doesn't really have much to do. He's just kind of a mysterious, slightly telepathic guy for some reason. You never explain where his magical powers come from. And he's much better in another film that's out this week called For Those in Peril. And I'd recommend people go and see that over this, just because it does that kind of magic realism thing so much better than this film does at a tenth of the budget. So this is a great setup, but for me it just wanders off into the forest and gets lost there.
What annoyed me about it was the absolute lack of context. Now, I know it's not about the Civil War and all the warring factions and that, but it was so just brushed under the carpet. There's just vague talk of terrorists. Yeah. There's kind of brigands in the woods. And you're supposed to think, oh, yeah, it's the end of the world. But you think, but why? What actually is going on here? And it's just not interested in that at all.
No, you're right. You never know who the threat is exactly. And you also, they start building a society after the attack happens, where they have like work camps and then farms that they have to go to help out the war effort. But again, that system's never explained either. So you wonder why they're ever doing it. They're just trudging around in their grey overalls, picking carrots off the ground and checking that they're not too full of radiation to eat. You know, you need to explain these systems and why they're happening, which to me something like Children of Men did very well. Like there was an implicit understanding that this is how you'd survive in this situation if you were going to try to.
At its best, it's a very, very distant cousin of A Canterbury Tale. And of course, Kevin MacDonald was Emmerich Pressburger's grandson. But and that sort of sense of rural Britain in the threat of war and the American who kind of lands there. And I kept thinking, I want it to be that, but it's not.
We could probably raise some funding on Kickstarter for that, so.
Okay, we'll do it. Nuclear Apocalypse, the cause and the cure of all life's problems in How I Live Now. And that's it from us. It's over and done with. It's over and done with. Heartfelt thanks, as ever, to Catherine Short and Henry Barnes. Thanks to you for not throwing bottles. We're back next week.